Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Conceiving, carrying, delivering, nurturing, and relating to your baby from their first moments until they walk out of your house to find their own destiny is the subject of today's interview. It all starts with the health of the mother and her mate and ripples out into the world with the person they create. How much of the development of a happy, healthy person is the responsibility of the parents, and how much is it fate in the form of environmental exposures, genetics, and bum luck? It seems to today's guest, Sally Fallon, much of it goes back to traditions of whole foods and plenty of protective fats, proteins, and plant foods, and kindness. Today we'll examine some of the details of how and why some of our oldest practices are still the best. First, an editorial by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. The Nation magazine has an ad for a company that sells clean energy. In the ad, the image of a smokestack belching pollution is on one side, and on the other, the image of a wind turbine. On the clean energy company's website, the effects of conventional energy production are compared to the effects of wind and solar energy. It's a dramatic contrast. On the one hand, we see the effect of combustion technology that uses the air as a dump site. Ironically, the clean energy company does not list health effects, but instead talks about more trendy greenhouse gas emissions causing climate change. On the other hand, the wind turbine gives us a sense that we can, as the company's motto says, make our future clean and green. What the company says is that wind turbines provide, quote, 100% clean energy that can reverse climate change, end quote. That green is clean and safe is one of the great myths of our age, sometimes with good intentions, as with this clean energy company. It's very socially responsible, for example, donating 50% of its profits to organizations such as the Blue-Green Alliance. In fact, the president of the company was one of my graduate school professors. He's smart on the left and a very decent person. Despite all that, wind turbines are not benign, and they are definitely not 100% clean. A recent article in Counterpunch describes the growing citizen resistance to the installation of wind turbines. People near wind turbines object to their noise, habitat destruction, and murder of birds. Clean and green energy proponents fight back using all the tricks of the political trade, discrediting the people who oppose wind farms, manipulating data to show public support, and gross violations of public health standards. The article, however, has its limits. Although noise pollution is a growing menace, wind turbine noise isn't the only health threat. In a review article published in the Bulletin of Science, Technology, and Society, Magda Havas and David Colling report that wind turbines cause health problems because they make waves, pressure waves and electromagnetic waves. Pressure waves affect people as audible noise, as described, for example, in the work of Dr. Louis Hagler, and as infrasound. That is, pressure waves that humans can't hear but nevertheless can have a physiological effect, including tissue damage. As for electromagnetic waves, wind turbines produce poor quality electricity because of variations in weather, tower construction, and electronics. It is of poor quality because these variations produce electricity over a wide range of frequencies that must be converted to a consistent 60 cycles per second. The variations around 60 cycles cause dirty electricity, which mechanically damages electronic equipment and physiologically damages human and animal health, as described in the work of Dr. Sam Milham. With pressure waves, the health effect is localized to the vicinity of the wind turbines. Audible noise can have an effect miles away, while subaudible infrasound can reach tens of miles away. But with dirty electricity created by wind turbines, the toxic variations in frequency can be carried hundreds of miles over the electricity grid. So this is hardly a 100% clean technology. It is instead an object of desire. It's a salve for climate change panic. The image is, it's just the wind blowing. What could be wrong with that? But it's not the wind. It's technology harnessing the wind, putting it in bondage. I'm all for integrating human activity with the cycles and forces of nature. I'm also for stopping the pollution of the air, and water and land for that matter. And I'm very much for working to make the world a better place. However, I'm also in favor of accommodating the likelihood that technology bites back, for which I refer you to the work of Dr. Edward Tenner. In other words, a reasonable person or a reasonable people should assume that any new technology will damage his, her, or its health. I did not say it might damage health. I said you should assume that it will damage your health until proven otherwise. To reinforce that gloomy idea, understand that wind power is generally considered uneconomical without the boatload of government subsidies lavished on it. The reason it lives on is that big wind is dominated by big oil. For example, one of the big players in wind power is Shell Oil Company. Big wind, like big oil, is not interested in your health. It's also not interested in being any percent clean or any percent green, except as it diverts attention from the harm they cause. A transcript of this editorial is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist who produces this show with me as primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. And now to the topic of today's show, which I'm calling Baby, From Beginning to End. And our guest, who is returning to the show after many previous shows in the past, we haven't had her on in a long time, Sally Fallon Morrell, is founding president of the Western A. Price Foundation at westernaprice.org and founder of a campaign for real milk, realmilk.com. Mrs. Fallon Morrell lectures extensively around the world on issues of health and nutrition and is the nation's number one spokeswoman for nutrient-dense diets for pregnant women and growing children. She's a prolific writer of numerous articles and books and serves as editor of Wise Traditions in Food Farming and the Healing Arts, the quarterly journal of the Weston A. Price Foundation. In 1996, Mrs. Fallon Morrell published the best-selling Nourishing Traditions with Mary G. Innig, Ph.D., the cookbook that launched her career in alternative health. Sally Fallon Morrell resides in Washington, D.C. with her husband, Jeffrey Morrell. She is the mother of four grown children. So you come to this work with a lot of experience.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. In fact,
I guess most books on baby and child care are written by parents.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them aren't, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think to be this immersed in a topic, and this book really is very, very, very complete. I mean, it's astonishing how much you've gotten into this slightly over 300-page book. It's just chock-a-block full. I mean, it's not decorated with a lot of huge illustrations because the material is so complete. You cover
everything you
can think of, and very well. I might add, one of the things that I found interesting is that it very much follows the tradition of Nourishing Traditions, which is that it reaches back in some ways to our early human traditions and the wisdom of those early traditions in contrast to some of the interventions that women experience now with so-called modern medicine.
Yeah, you know, there couldn't be a greater contrast between the modern and the so-called primitive attitude about pregnancy and babies. What Dr. Weston Price found when he studied traditional peoples was that they realized that during pregnancy and the early years of growth of the child, you needed extra nutrition. You needed extremely abundant nutrition. And so the pregnant women and the babies, when they started to be weaned, had very nutrient-dense foods like liver, butter from grass-fed animals. Fish eggs were considered extremely important, and can't think of a more nutrient-dense food than fish eggs. And certain parts of the fish, certain organ meats. So that is not what we're seeing today. Today the attitude is, well, you know, just eat your green vegetables, and that's all you need to worry about. And then if something goes wrong, we blame it on what I call the two G's, the genes and germs. Whereas the traditional peoples understood that it was entirely up to them, and if something went wrong, it was their fault because they had not provided a superabundance of they wouldn't say vitamins and minerals, of course, but these special nutrient-dense, what we call sacred foods.
Well, it's clear that in our economic system, the food industry is pushing a bunch of fake foods that are supposedly enriched with various vitamins, which if we hadn't been marketed the idea that food is basic recreation instead of learning from early childhood, as your proponent here, to eat these nutrient-dense foods like livers and fish and things like that, so that people don't go ew when they hear those words. If people were used to eating these foods, you would never, you know, you don't need a prenatal a vitamin with synthetic forms of iron and things like that that are actually fairly toxic if you're eating the foods that are this rich. I mean, I'm still an advocate of a basic multivitamin and some extra vitamin C throughout the day, but if you eat really nutrient-dense foods, as our ancestors did, you're well set up for pregnancy.
Absolutely. In fact, this book warns against prenatal vitamins, talks about some of the things that are wrong with them. It does provide one recommendation for vitamin if you feel you need to take them. But if the whole attitude is you don't really have to worry about what you eat because you can take your prenatal vitamin.
Yeah. Oh no. And they're selling them horrible fake foods. So
yeah,
the only thing that, you know, you bring up some very important issues here. One of them, of course, I would add is that before you get pregnant, when you start thinking about becoming pregnant, it's very important to make sure your thyroid is working. And that, of course, goes back to nutrient dense foods and getting sufficient iodine in the diet.
Right. You really need to prepare for pregnancy, and that's what our mothers are not doing today. And we recommend at least 6 months preparation with nutrient-dense foods and up to 2 years if you have had either a vegan-vegetarian diet or a standard American diet with lots of junk food. The payoff in having a healthy baby, a healthy, alert, intelligent, smiling baby is so great. And you really can pretty much guarantee success with the right kind of diet. But unfortunately, it's the very diet that young women and young parents are being told they shouldn't eat. It's a very rich, high cholesterol, high fat diet.
Yeah, and in addition, the presence of animal proteins, despite what people may feel morally about eating our relatives and cousins on the planet, you may have emotional feelings about it, but when it comes to it, one of the problems with being a strict vegan, where there's no animal protein, is that your detoxification pathways, and boy, in this modern time with the amount of insults that we're getting, exposures, better work, and they stop working when you stop eating sulfur containing amino acids. So if there is if there aren't any animal products in the diet,
right,
then the detox pathways don't work and you're carrying a toxic load. Let me just very quickly let the audience know that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and we're on the phone delightfully again with Sally Fallon Morrell and her new book, The Nourishing Traditions Book of Baby and Child Care. So, the exposures have become astronomical, and now we have this added layer, which I was very pleased to see you cover, of RF and EMF, these electromagnetic spectrums.
Yes. Now, you know, you hate to make people so paranoid that they end up not having any children, and there's no question we live in the electronic age, and it's very hard to escape. But there are certain things that I do recommend to minimize your exposure to all these EMFs. And I do believe that diet can play a very large part in providing a certain measure of protection.
Okay. So, but you would, I think, as you do in the book, suggest that women, I would, based on the research, I mean, you know, there's always been something to be paranoid about. There's always been something to be concerned about. The world has always been ending under our feet.
Right,
it's always been that way. But I would very strongly say that, as we've been covering on the air recently, pregnant women should avoid the use of cell phones if possible.
Absolutely. That's one thing you can do, is not use cell phones. Try to have DSL, not wireless, in your house.
Well, or just a cable.
Yeah.
Wired cable, or even if you're out in the country and you're using a satellite, you can still wire in with an Ethernet cable.
Right, right. So there really are a lot of things that you can do to minimize that exposure. But at the same time, my own experience is here. I live downtown. We're surrounded by all of these towers and everything. But they don't bother us. We've never had the slightest problem with them. But I do think it's because we eat a very high-fat diet.
Lots
of sulfur in the diet.
Yes, I'm sure that having your detox pathways work and having your liver be healthy and all that helps. Unfortunately, what we're learning now with the amount of research is now these 1,800 new studies, the bioinitiative.org with the new studies, is that people don't have to have symptoms to be to get sick and have cancers and heart disease from these things. So it's still good to try to stay away from
absolutely.
The exposures as much as you can. Now, there's another thing that's happening with these exposures, which is that men's sperm is becoming people are becoming infertile.
Right.
So men who want to have a baby don't want to be putting a cell phone anywhere near any part of their body. If it's up in a breast pocket, they get breast cancer. If it's in their pants pocket, they get problems with their sperm motility. So.
Right.
Okay. So along with not having an easy time getting pregnant, there are probably some diets that help with some issues with fertility there in terms of diet as well.
Yes, and although this book is not specifically a book about fertility, it assumes it's really a book about what happens when you get pregnant. The diet that we recommend to prepare for pregnancy is a great fertility diet. And as Kayla Daniel warns in the book, be careful, because we have a lot of people who start on this diet and they don't take care to not get pregnant, and they get pregnant too soon before they're really ready.
Get rid of the soy.
The first thing that the diet will do, with lots of butter and the cod liver oil and getting off the soy and all the bad things, is you're likely to get pregnant.
Mm.
So you want to make sure that, you know, a number of months go by so you can really build up your nutritional stores.
Sure enough.
Because really, as soon as you become pregnant, things are happening that require those nutrients, particularly vitamin A. And by the time the baby's heart has by the time you know you're pregnant, the baby's heart has already formed.
Mm.
And if you haven't built up the nutritional stores that you need, you could have a defect. It could not form at all, and you have a miscarriage. So preparation for pregnancy was universal among traditional peoples and has completely disappeared in modern culture.
Now, as soon as a woman announces that she's pregnant, if she has a regular relationship with a conventional doctor, the medical assault starts.
Absolutely, and there's a whole chapter in the book on interventions in pregnancy and what to do about them, and my biggest concern is ultrasound. And not just women getting many, many ultrasounds, which they don't need to get, but also the fetal heart monitor that they use in the doctor's office. They say that's a Doppler instrument. Well, that's ultrasound, too. So one of the first questions that you want to ask your gynecologist, obstetrician, is to use a stethoscope. It's actually called a fetoscope, an old-fashioned way of listening to the baby's heart.
What is your problem with ultrasound? People traditionally have thought, it's not, ionizing radiation, so it should be okay. It's just sound waves.
Well,
but
it's
new
sound
research.
Waves, and sound
new,
waves
new research.
You can kill people with sound waves.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, you're dealing with a very small, vulnerable being. In one test, they actually listened to the sound in the uterus, and it sounded like a big train coming into the station. It's very loud.
Nice.
The frequent use of ultrasound is associated with delays in speech, especially speech problems in children. And, of course, now we have an epidemic of speech problems. There are researchers who believe it has contributed to the epidemic of autism. It was in the late 80s, I believe, that the FDA allowed them to use stronger ultrasounds than they had been using before. So they were really pounding these babies with the sound waves. And that's when we saw the great leap in autism, too. So I do think it should be considered as a factor. And it's just, what Jeff was saying, with a new technology, to hold the thought that it might be toxic, but assume it's toxic until you know otherwise.
Until it's been tested to be otherwise.
It's been tested, and I would say that the research out there, and there, I quote, many studies in the book, a whole page of studies about ultrasound, show that it is something to be avoided.
Sure. The other thing that is interesting is that there is indeed research that shows that if a woman picks up a virus while she's pregnant, it's likely to cause some psychiatric disturbances and changes in the brain development of the infant. So the most obvious thing to do is not to go out and get a flu shot, but to actually consider the possibility of avoiding crowds and being cautious about not catching the flu when you're...
Well, one of the things, I do discuss this, not exactly in that context, but I discuss it in the context of rubella, the rubella virus. Why is it so problematic? Well, any virus creates a reaction in the body that uses up vitamin A. And it's the lack of vitamin A that then results in the problems, because the brain needs vitamin A to develop. So this is why we put so much emphasis on vitamin A in the book, with the cod liver oil and the other vitamin A-rich foods like liver.
Vitamin C, also very important as an antioxidant, and vitamin E. The other things you urge people to be considering while pregnant is staying cool, and why?
Yes, because too much heat can, it actually inactivates the, you know, myriad enzymes that the baby's using for growth, and just small changes in temperature. So that doesn't mean you can't take a nice hot shower if you're not in very long, but long soaks in the tub and hot tubs and things you want to avoid. And if you get a fever, we have ways of, you know, natural ways of bringing the fever down too.
Yeah, I noticed that. Another problem that young women are having these days is a lot of them are having some metabolic disruptions, and so their glucose tolerance is poor because they're eating a lot of fake foods and a lot of sugar.
Right, blood sugar, yes, right, right.
Okay, and then high blood pressure would follow on with that, as well as being maybe exposure to too much wireless and too much stress.
Right, and of course we're getting a lot of women going, you know, they deliver them early if their blood pressure is high.
Mm-hmm.
Because very often toxemia follows. And so, yes, you know, all these problems are filling our hospital wards with premature babies,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And we even assume that 38 is normal gestation time now, when actually it's 42 weeks. So a lot of babies are just being induced at 38 weeks because our doctors feel they shouldn't wait any longer. And so you have a whole month that they could have been developing their lungs inside when, you know, they have to breathe.
One interesting thing we found in an interview we did is that babies actually, we birth our babies sooner than other mammals because of the size of the head. So babies are born, and in a way, they're actually in their fourth trimester. You know, they're not really supposed to be out yet.
Yeah,
so
right.
That's why they're so vulnerable, is that we have to keep them in as long as we can. And then you talk about alternatives to speeding birth if something happens and that has to happen.
Well, we just avoid, you know, urge mothers, pregnant women, to resist any calls to induce their babies as long as everything is going fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's very hard once they get in this situation with a doctor wanting to induce, or if they're having problems, it's sometimes very hard to avoid the whole intervention that leads to cesarean and so forth. And I don't want to be too negative about this, because cesareans do save lives in many cases, and save babies, especially today when, you know, our whole society is so unhealthy. So I describe normal birth in there, and then I describe the cesarean birth and what you can do to minimize the ill consequences of that.
Right after birth, again, the medical assaults start.
Oh, yes, yes.
So.
You know, first thing they want to do is wipe the baby off. And there's a vernix caseosa. It's a kind of covering that's full of wonderful things for the skin and very protective. And I learned this after I wrote the book. But do you know that just a couple of decades ago, they actually swabbed the babies down in a Clorox solution?
Oh, boy.
At least things like that have stopped.
Well, bacteria is natural, and it primes the baby's immune system.
Yep. Yeah.
And then there's the eye drops and the vitamin K shot and the
right.
Hep B vaccination and the blood tests.
And right, and all of those things I warn against and try to avoid. You may not be able to avoid them all, but certainly parents should be prepared for these things. They need to interview first their doctor and the hospital. They need to go in armed with a list of what they don't want. If anything, a letter from their lawyer. And, of course, the worst one is the hepatitis B vaccine at the day, 1 day old. Totally, there's no threat to these babies of Hep B, and the vaccine is just pouring toxins into the bloodstream at the, in the tiny, tiny babies.
Additionally, as far as the vitamin K shot, babies, because of their situation, have extra clotting mechanisms going on. They don't need a shot of vitamin K.
They really don't. And of course, we're urging mothers to get lots of good vitamin K when they're pregnant.
Lots of dark greens.
And it will be in their breast milk if they are eating the way we recommend.
So now that you've brought up breast milk, let's talk about breastfeeding. You're a proponent, obviously.
I'm a proponent, although a lot of people accuse me of not being a proponent. I'm a proponent, but I also strongly urge that mothers eat our diet so that their milk will be of the highest quality. And the breastfeeding groups sort of put out the premise that it really doesn't matter what you eat as long as you breastfeed, and that is not the
Yeah, actually, I've not heard that from them. What I've heard mostly is that the immune building properties of breast milk still prime the immune system and protect the infant, even if there is a toxic burden, which there is no matter what you do. I mean, toxic burdens have been tested on people who have been very careful and avoided stuff, and they're full of stuff. You know, so it's almost
the fats and the fat-soluble vitamins and even a lot of the minerals. B12, they'll all be lower if the mother is not eating properly.
Okay, and then you talk a bit and have done in the past about the scandal of commercial formulas and especially soy formulas, how dangerous they are, and you have some great formula recipes if that is necessary.
Right. Now, this is it's actually called the Fallon formula. It's really out there in the cyberspace. It is a homemade formula based on raw milk. Either cow or goat's milk, raw whole milk, but certain things are done to the formula to make it more in line with breast milk. For example, it is diluted with a fresh whey because mother's milk is higher in whey than most animals. We have extra vitamin C. We add cod liver oil. We add some cream, etc. And we now have almost 15 years of mothers using this formula with uniformly good reports about how well their babies do. And this formula is for mothers who adopt. It's for mothers who don't have enough milk, and contrary to what you may hear, that is now about 15% of nursing mothers. It is for mothers who have to go back to work and are unable to pump at work, and there's lots of situations like that. And I will say this also, it's for mothers who, for whatever reason, just don't want to breastfeed. And I don't think that's right, but I am not going to criticize these mothers. I would rather show them that there is an alternative that will still result in a healthy baby. Because after all, we don't want to discriminate against the babies whose mothers don't want to breastfeed. We want to make sure that they have access to this formula.
And you have a formula that's a non-dairy formula that's remarkable as well.
Yes, we do. And there is a meat-based formula that has saved babies' lives.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Liver and stuff.
Saved babies' lives. Yeah.
And babies don't go ooh when you give it to them.
No, it actually, I made this formula when we first put the formula together, and it's we add lactose to it, so it's like a mother's milk in that respect, and it's sweet tasting. It tastes good.
Yeah. So we need to break for just a few moments here. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone today with Sally Fallon Morrell, who is co-author of Nourishing Traditions' book of baby and child care, and we will return to this interview in just a moment if you'll stay with us.
You have no right to push and shove us little kids around. Now just because your throat has got a deeper voice and lots of wind to blow it out at little kids who don't dare shout, You have no right, you have no right to boss and beat us little kids about. Just because you've whiskers on your face to shave, you treat us like a slave. So what? It's only hair. Just because you wear a wallet near your heart, you think you're twice as smart. You know that isn't fair. But we'll grow up someday, and when we do, I pray, we won't just grow in size and sound, and just be bigger by the pound. I'd hate to grow like some I know, who push and shove the little kids around.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm doing a show with Sally Fallon Morrell today called Baby from Beginning to End. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for information about this show and almost 700 other shows. Free access to recordings as downloads, all of them, a free newsletter about upcoming shows, and more. yourownhealthandfitness.org. Sally, can you remind us of the email that they can use, or not the email, but the website for your organization?
For the Weston A. Price Foundation, it's WESTONAPRICE.org. And the book is available in bookstores and, online booksellers. But you can also go to newtrendspublishing.com and read a couple of sample chapters from the book.
And the book, again, is The Nourishing Traditions, Book of Child and Baby Care.
Baby and Child Care, yes.
Oh, Baby and Child Care. Yeah. That would make sense to have the baby happen first. So we were talking about EMF and RF, and indeed, even after the baby is born, there are still developmental issues, and it's still prudent to avoid exposing them to high levels or even low levels of EMF and RF. So baby monitors. Yeah.
Yes, the baby monitors put out a lot of EMF. Now, ironically, the ones made in England only they turn off when the baby's not crying. In other words, they're like motion sensitive, they're sound sensitive. So they're only on when the baby is crying, but the ones in the United States are on all the time. So that's constant exposure to EMF in the baby's room while the baby's sleeping.
There are, I think, better ways. What would you recommend?
Well, I recommend having the baby in a little porta-crib or something near where you're working. Keep the baby's door open at night or have the baby in the room with you so you don't have to have a monitor. And, you know, I think it's good for babies to learn to sleep with lots of activity going on around them.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there is a point where the baby stops. How long do you like to see women breastfeed? Some women just breastfeed as long as the baby will, as long as the child wants to breastfeed. I mean, it's...
Right, and that's fine. The thing that I'm pretty adamant about is that exclusive breastfeeding not continue past age 6 months. That because by that time the baby does need iron-rich foods and more iron than the mother can give in the breast milk, and you tend to see babies kind of pale and pasty who have been exclusively breastfed too long. And traditional cultures introduced solid foods about 6 months. Usually it was liver that the mother had chewed for the baby. So we recommend pureed liver, egg yolks, you know, good iron-rich foods, foods rich in lots of good things.
Well, don't stop. Keep talking about the foods you want baby to eat.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, you know, the modern practice is to give babies grains as soon as the first weaning food, and that's a terrible idea because what we've ended up with is, well, the baby has a very hard time digesting those grains, and what we've ended up with is a whole generation who's extremely sensitive to grains. And, you know, whether or not you want to include grains in their diet, my goal in this book is to show mothers how to introduce the foods, what to feed them as they grow, so that when they do grow, when they become fully developed babies into children, they can eat everything. I mean, that's a great gift to give a child, to be able to eat anything. And what we have is this terrible situation where children are, you know, they can't eat anything with corn or they can't eat anything with wheat. Now, most of this stuff is garbage, but it's really hard to keep children off foods that contain one of these major ingredients.
Oh, would you please go on a tear against Cheerios? Because I do this thing with the cold cereal all the time. I'd like you to do it.
I have a sidebar on Cheerios. Well, this is what's given to these little babies, and the what mothers are told is that Cheerios are good because they have a hole in them, and so the baby won't choke. And so everyone thinks that Cheerios is the greatest thing to give to a little baby to shut them up if they're crying. And you see mothers in airports with their little bag of Cheerios. I just can't think of anything worse to give a baby. First of all, it's grains loaded with sugar. They are extruded, and the extrusion process creates some very toxic proteins, some neurotoxic proteins. There is no food value in these Cheerios at all. It's negative nutrition.
Yeah, the box would be more nutritious.
Yeah,
let them chew on the box.
Yeah. And, you know, I talk about traveling with a baby. You know, you can take hunks of little chunks of cheese, little chunks of salami, is something that's really a nutrient dense. It's got fat in it, so they don't have the blood sugar roller coasters. You were mentioning that earlier.
What kind of salami, though? Not the usual with the...
A good natural salami.
Natural.
Which, is, by the way, is a lacto-fermented food, so mm-hmm. there's even enzymes in good salami. Mm-hmm.
What other lacto-fermented foods can you get into an infant?
Well, you can start early with these naturally fermented foods. Yogurt is a good one, a whole yogurt. We recommend introducing some pickles and sauerkraut quite early.
Yeah, and the juice, if nothing else, the juice will have it.
Yes. Right.
Yeah, I like that stuff when I was... and then we just... avoiding a addicted baby, I think, is an interesting topic.
Well, we're just wondering whether some of the ingredients in baby formula are addicting. We just don't know. But
so what are you saying? You're saying just always use whole foods, make your own things. Don't,
Oh, yes, make your own baby food, and, you know, eyes roll when I say this, but...
Not that hard to do. It's pretty simple food.
It's really not hard.
Food processor, there you go.
If you're not willing to cook for your baby and your family and to prepare real foods, and they can be quite simple, it doesn't mean you have to spend hours in the kitchen.
Do an example of a baby food recipe.
Well, the liver, the first liver for the baby, you saute the liver in a little butter and plonk it in the food processor with some more butter, a little salt, and enough water to thin it.
Maybe some cream?
Yeah, some cream would be great. Mm-hmm. And just put that in very small dishes and freeze it. And then you have instant liver servings for your baby.
And where is it in the world that they carry little dried fishes as
snacks for babies? Oh, yes, I talk about in Japan, one of the foods they give children are these little dried whole fishes. They're salty and crunchy and extremely nutrient-dense food, and the children have these special little cases they
carry
their
them
fishes in.
And salt is good for babies.
Absolutely, baby. You know, mother's milk is over 50% fat, most of it saturated fat, and that should be our model in feeding our children. Unfortunately, the pediatricians are taught to tell mothers that when the child reaches the age of two, and sometimes they're doing this now at the age of one, to restrict fats in the children. And this, to me, is child abuse. It
mm-hmm.
is starving your child for the very things that he needs to grow normally, and denying him the birthright of optimal and normal development.
Yeah. Well, and also avoiding iron-fortified foods, I would say.
Yes.
Obviously,
yeah.
Because if you're giving him liver. So,
right.
So just to remind people, you are, again, listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, Jeff Fawcett sitting by, and we are interviewing Sally Fallon Morrell from the Western A. Price Foundation, westernaprice.org, and the book is Nourishing Traditions, Book of Baby and Child Care.
And Lena, that's Weston, W-E-S-T-O-N. That's the man's name.
WestonAPrice.org.
Yes.
Thanks.
Yes.
Okay, so now one of the things that can happen, but I think it's very complicated. My brother and I were both colic babies, and it was extreme. But I think there was other reasons. I mean, I think it very much was a reflection of my mother's stress level. This was during World War II and all the rest of it. So, there's an issue in some cases where babies seem to have gastrointestinal symptoms right out of the gate and have trouble with dairy. But I'm always suspicious of why that might be, and I think you talk a little bit about colic.
I actually spend, quite a few pages on colic because it can be so distressing for the mothers. Once again, a lot of it has to do with the maturity of the digestive tract. So that means the nutrient-dense diet during pregnancy and not having your baby too early and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It can have to do with the mother's milk. There could be problems with the mother's milk not having enough fat in it. And if the mother's eating a standard American diet, it may not have enough fat. We recommend, there's a lot of little natural treatments we recommend. There's a homeopathic treatment for colic. Sometimes even very gentle osteopathic manipulation can help colic. One of the simplest things, of course, and it's something that mothers are not taught anymore, is to burp your baby. Put him upright and on your shoulder and rub his back until you get that burp out.
I'm shocked as a father of two daughters. Uh-huh. One of the great rituals of being a father is getting up at night and rubbing. It was almost, I don't even know that anyone taught me that. I pick them up and rub their back and I get this big healthy burp and then we all go back to sleep. I'm shocked.
I know it's hard to believe, but it's something that's not being taught anymore.
Well, and I also think the stress level of the mother is huge when it comes to the health of the gastrointestinal system.
Yeah.
Because you're going to carry all that cortisol into your kid through the breast milk. And
I actually talk about that if the mother's adrenals are stressed, you can end up with a baby with stressed adrenals.
Yep, I can attest to that. I'm a living example. And I should mention that Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett here did, in fact, raise particularly one of his children pretty much as a single father for a good part of the time. So he is a baby meister. He's a baby expert. I am not. I do not have children, but he does. He is. You have to be careful because if you have a baby and he comes to your house, he's likely to grab the baby and bathe it. and it shrieks, and he's also a lot of fun in a grocery store.
And Zerbits as well. Blowing on the stomach and getting the scream.
Making obscene noises.
Always a good thing.
Yeah, always good. So making babies laugh. So we have this issue of how babies become food allergic. It's a very complicated issue. Sometimes it even runs in the family line, but a lot of it can happen as a result, as you said, of what kinds of food. So a lot of colicky babies are often given dairy formula and dairy, cow dairy, pasteurized, conventional stuff is irritating and can set up the kid for future gut problems.
Oh, absolutely. It's extremely hard to
and
digest.
Never even mind the soy, which is devastating to the thyroid and all that. But then we have the problem of, we have the healing of the gastrointestinal. We have the avoiding the gastrointestinal by feeding them real foods and using unpasteurized.
And avoiding the highly allergenic foods such as pasteurized dairy and whole grains or grains. We recommend at least wait to 1 year, and if this is a problem in the family, you should wait longer. I'll just give you a very nice example. My own daughter is very sensitive to wheat, probably because I introduced grains too early. I didn't know any better, and she just cannot do wheat. So we were very careful with my grandson and kept him from the wheat and very nutrient-dense, high-fat diet, cod liver oil, very important for building a healthy gut. And now at the age of 4, he can eat anything. He is not sensitive to wheat, so that's a great gift.
Yeah, although there are better grains.
We vary the grains, but believe me, in our culture, it is really hard if you can't even do a little tiny bit of wheat. Because you're going to have to be careful all your life.
Yeah, although I mean, if you eat a sort of Paleolithic style diet, it's kind of a non-issue. You can get used to it, but I take your point, and it is better to be flexible.
The goal is children who can deal with the environment, who are so strong that it doesn't hurt them if they have some white bread or if they have sugar at a birthday party. I mean, what we're trying to avoid is hothouse children that you have to watch all the time to make sure they're not getting a tiny bit of wheat or a tiny bit of peanuts or whatever. Mm-hmm. We want healthy, robust children that can live in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean they don't need a good diet all their lives, but we need to be realistic here, and your child's diet's not ever going to be perfect.
Now, what I was kind of working my way up to is fussy eaters, and I think sometimes when you've got a fussy eater, what you've got is a kid who is refusing certain foods because they don't feel good to them.
Texture-wise.
Well, I was very averse to milk, and it turns out that I had the worst milk allergy anyone's ever seen, and by the time I was 9 years old, I had a bleeding gastritis from it.
So,
but I hated it, and I kept pushing it away, and they kept saying, you know, you have to have it. Blah, blah, blah. So I sometimes think that the fussy eating thing is not just that you've spoiled your child; it's also could be that there's something about what you're feeding them that isn't agreeing with them.
Well, certainly, if a child has a really strong visceral reaction to a food, mom, you need to take note and not keep forcing this food. However, my philosophy is that parents need to be totally in control of what the child eats those first few years. There's a section in there in the book about baby-led weaning, and I think that is an absolutely terrible idea. Moms know, you know, following our advice, know what to give these babies. The food should be pureed. It should be mixed with good fats. And the problem with baby-led weaning is you're giving chunks of food to babies way too soon for them to get good nutrition from them.
And is it your experience that when people follow these, you know, making your own foods and pureeing them and adding and doing a varied diet, not hammering away with the same foods all the time, that the babies tend not to be fussy?
Absolutely.
Ah, that's great.
They're wonderful eaters.
Yeah.
And we get reports almost daily from parents who've raised their children this way, and they're just so thrilled that it's really wonderful when you have a child who's a good eater and he'll try new things and, you know, he's not pushing food away. And this really comes from, I believe, the parents taking control, of course, making sure that what's being fed tastes good to the child, but introducing different textures from an early age and so forth.
And again, you've got some wonderful recipes.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what you do, is
the
recipes.
Yeah, there's a good recipe section in the back.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got a cultured milk smoothie.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want that?
Yeah, right.
You know, except for me being allergic to dairy. But
it's a burden that you carry to be so allergic to dairy or wheat or whatever it is.
And oh, it's a pain. Yeah, it is.
It's a complete pain, and so the goal is to have children with good, sturdy guts and good appetites.
Well, and I also noticed... Oh, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, just so that they don't have to worry about all of these things. I'm still not recommending giving pasteurized milk to your child.
No.
But believe me, in this era, they're going to have some pasteurized milk products. It's very hard not to,
of course,
to keep that away from them. Yes.
Yeah. Now, you've got, you know, some wonderful, easy recipes here, for instance, with, you've got a sweet potato custard, which is a wonderful way.
Oh, my grandson loves that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and also to get some starch into a baby that's not, you know, that isn't grains,
yeah,
you know, alternative starches,
exactly,
too,
yeah,
which is more Paleolithic. And then you've got how to do a cereal gruel made out of alternative grains,
right,
and even culturing the grains so that they're easy to digest. You've got all these recipes in here. They're wonderful.
Yeah. No traditional culture eats grains the way we do. All traditional cultures fermented their grains or did a sourdough or soaked them or something to pre-digest these grains, because human beings we don't have the digestive apparatus to digest grains. We need to do a pre-digestion before we eat them. And so then we turn around and give this food, which is the hardest food for humans to digest, we give it to babies unpre-digested as their first food when they're 6 months old or even 2 months old. And we're just doing them a terrible disservice, and no wonder we're seeing the widespread problems with wheat and other grains today.
One thing I was happy to see in your book this time around is the inclusion of the GAP diet, because for better or worse, there are children who will have some
yes.
problems. So
yes.
why don't you explain what the GAP diet is okay. and how you incorporate it in?
So the GAP diet is recommended for children with autism, for children with behavior problems, for children with allergies and autoimmune problems. And it's a diet that gets rid of, at least at first, all disaccharides. Because what it is that the lining of the stomach produces disaccharides for digesting disaccharides. But in these cases of poor health, the stomach is not doing that. So any lactose or grains or even potatoes are going to cause tremendous distress, digestive distress and allergies, and then, of course, the neurological problems, because you get the proliferation of all sorts of bad things in the gut, including true toxins produced by the funguses and so forth. So the diet takes the GAPS diet, removes all of those, and does a lot of things to heal the gut, like bone broth and cod liver oil. And it's a diet that's meant to heal the gut and is not necessarily intended to be a lifelong diet. It's to get you back to eating a fairly normal diet again.
But you do include in your fermented recipes that you can either... Now, we've had Sandra Katz on several times, and we know that we can ferment foods without... Many foods ferment without any whey. You like using the whey, but you also suggest in some cases just adding some sauerkraut juice.
Right. I've modified a lot of my recipes from Nourishing Traditions for this GAPS diet, and you use sauerkraut juice when you don't need whey to make sauerkraut, so... Yeah.
Now, here's an interesting thing as we go onwards toward adulthood. You talk a little bit about issues with iron and, you know, actually, this is a book about raising babies and children, but iron is very important. It's, you can't detoxify without enough iron, so becoming anemic is dangerous, but also iron overload later in life for men and for postmenopausal women can become higher in iron and have to... maybe give blood once in a while, or even just switch to eating, you know, marinated pork and other meats that are a little less hot in terms of iron. But you talk about iron and young men. What happens to the uncommunicative? It's very interesting.
So this is in the later chapter. We're talking about the teenage years. It's quite interesting that in men and boys, when they go through puberty, their iron levels in their blood go up just a little bit, but it's pretty uniform across the board. And this section was written by Dr. Cal, and it's anthroposophical view that this is what makes boys so uncommunicative. It's just this vibration of having too much iron, and so don't expect anything else, because that's what happens when they go through adolescence.
And interestingly, with girls and young women as they reach puberty, if they're eating too many refined, if they're eating a lot of sweet foods so that their blood sugars are not stable, their ovaries will stop producing progesterone and start producing testosterone, and they move into metabolic syndrome, so they start having irregular periods, they break out, they've got greasy hair and whatnot.
Yeah.
And this is from this kind of sugar-addicted,
yes.
processed food-addicted
yes.
thing. And,
yes.
and, you know, when women come to me and say, well, they want to put her on birth control pills, and I say, well, let's change her diet first.
Yes.
Usually that works to stabilize the blood sugar and get it. And lastly, as we get close to the end here, you're concerned about something you call the self-esteem trap in terms of raising children.
Yes, yes. You know, I'm very hands-off as children grow up. My philosophy is if you feed them right, then you can just sort of step back and watch them grow with great delight. Don't interfere with their playing and let them play. That's something that children know how to do and adults don't. And don't keep praising them all the time. The child just wants to be normal. He doesn't want to be special. And when you create this expectation in the child that it's going to be different and special, you actually engender a lot of stress in the child and even a great amount of loneliness. What children want more than anything is to be normal. And that's what we're trying to accomplish in this book.
Boy, do I agree with that. Because the other side of it is that they'll praise one kid and denigrate another. So it's very,
right.
very tricky.
Yeah.
Favorite children. Let's as we've got still a few more moments, but I know another thing that's important is sunlight.
Oh my goodness!
Huge.
Into this, I talk about how fearful we are of natural things. We're fearful of germs. You know, we're fearful of raw milk, we're fearful of the child's natural immunity, and we're so afraid of sunlight. And we've gone from a culture that deliberately put the babies outside, that we had a lot of rickets a number of decades ago, and these babies were given sun therapy, and they were actually put under ultraviolet lights, kind of tanning beds, as a therapy for this. And now we have gone to a culture that is slathering sunscreen, and this sunscreen has a lot of problems, including a lot of estrogenic components. And there are parents that put sunscreen all over a child's body, then put its clothes on and send them off to school just in case there might be a smidgen of skin that's exposed to the sun.
Vitamin D here.
Yeah, the vitamin D and the bad effects of the sunscreen. So babies need to be in the sun. You need to start slowly and build up, but a 12-pound baby can be put in this, have a little sun bath every day if it's warm enough.
Yeah, you obviously don't want to burn a baby, but a light-skinned baby can tolerate probably 15 minutes of unprotected sun between 12 and 2 during the sunny time.
Absolutely.
And darker babies, as the skin, the darker the skin, the more time, so maybe 20 minutes or more for darker-skinned babies. The other thing is it's terribly important not to put sunglasses on your baby's eyes, because we've learned from people who know about eyes that damages.
I didn't even think about that one.
Mm-hmm.
That's not in there, but obviously.
No, very important not to use sun.
It never occurred to me to put sunglasses on a baby.
Never good.
Yeah.
All right, so once again, if you could, we're speaking with Sally Fallon Morrell. The book is Nourishing Traditions, Book for Baby and Child Care. If you could give out your various websites.
Okay, so if you want to read some sample chapters of the book or even to order the book, it's newtrendspublishing.com. That's newtrends publishing.com. If you'll click on the cover of the book behind there, you'll find a couple of sample chapters and the table of contents.
Okay.
The book's available in bookstores and online bookstores. And
Then
Weston A. Price Foundation is westonaprice.org.
Great. Sally Fallon Morrell, thank you once again for a lively interview and for your work.
Oh, thank you, Lena. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
And for me as well. Bye-bye for now.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us today. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. For information about this show and almost 700 other shows, free access to recordings as downloads, all of them, a free newsletter about upcoming shows, and more, it's all at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeffrey Fawcett. Being informed not only protects your health and your environment, it protects your freedom.